Welcome to Biblical Foundations, a podcast of the Center for Biblical Studies at Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. I'm your co-host, Jimmy Rowe, along with Dr. Andreas Kostenberger. Join us as we discuss issues in biblical scholarship for the church.
Thank you for joining us today at Biblical Foundations. I'm here with Dr. Kostenberger, and today we're joined by Dr. Ben Glad. Dr. Glad is Associate Professor of New Testament at Reformed Theological Seminary. He's the author and co-author of several books, including From Adam and Israel to the Church, A Biblical Theology of the People of God, the inaugural volume in the Essential Studies of Biblical Theology series, which he edits, published by IVP Academic. Dr. Glad, it's a pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Hey, thank you so much. I'm glad to be virtually here.
Yes, Ben, so good to have you as a guest in our program today. Really enjoyed getting to know each other over the last couple of years. Some may not be familiar with you and your work, so let's start out by, you know, please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you teach, your background, family, favorite sports team.
Yeah, so I live in Jackson, Mississippi. I teach at RTS Jackson, of course, and it's going on 9 years. Got here in 2012. I've been married for 15, July 9th. Yeah. It's probably felt like 5 or 7. It has not felt like 15. It's crazy. Time goes by so fast when you're having fun. Mm-hmm. I have two kids, Judah and Simon. They are 10 and 7. Mm-hmm. I'm from Maryland. My wife is from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I grew up in a conservative Christian home and a dispensational home at that, which is sort of what prompted me to write on Adam and Israel. We mm-hmm. can get into that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I grew up in a conservative fundamentalist. I even spent my first 2 years of college at Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina. And then I went from there to the Master's College that John MacArthur is associated with that. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went to Wheaton College, got my MA and PhD at Wheaton. And it really wasn't until Wheaton when I started to read the Bible as a whole. So it's really sort of my journey. And a lot of my work kind of comes out of my own journey and where I see myself now and how things are put together. What else? I'm trying to think. Oh, my favorite sports team. So I grew up in Maryland. I grew up watching the Redskins. Mm-hmm. Haven't been very good for very long. It's quite depressing. But then when I moved to Chicago, I was there for about 10 years. I watched the Bears. The Bears are fun to watch. They're about a mediocre team. I enjoy the Bears. Now here locally, we have the Saints. With Drew Brees. So I like the Saints. I'm a Saints fan. I've been to a game. It really is a good team to cheer for. So,
well,
as far as football goes.
You know, I'm from the D.C. area, and then I lived a dozen or so years in Chicago. So I feel your pain.
Oh, yeah. I know. I should have grown up in Boston or something. You know,
that's right. Exactly.
I missed out. I should have gone to Gordon Conwell. How about that?
Yeah, well, we moved to Chicago, you know, when I studied there at Trinity. I think it was in 90, and I guess moved to the States in 85. So the Bears were really good those years.
Really good then, so remember,
that was also the time the Chicago Bulls were really mm-hmm. good. So, you know, what a treat.
I wish I lived in Chicago. Yeah. In the mid-90s, just to watch. Oh, yeah. Nothing like that has ever happened in any sport. Nobody's ever seen anything like that. Oh, right. Man.
Absolutely. It's all about timing, you know?
Yeah. It is about timing. Right. Yeah, this sports season is not going to be a very good one.
No,
so no matter who you're cheering for, it's not going to be good.
Mm. Well, Ben, as we all know, there are quite a few biblical theology series already, which, by the way, speaks well of the, you know, the popularity of the discipline. I happen to edit or co-edit a couple of those series myself, the Biblical Theology of the New Testament series, which is an 8-volume series with Zondervan, and incidentally, I just finished editing Doug Moo's volume on the theology of Paul, which I'm really excited about. And so we're kind of entering the home stretch. That's going to be volume 5 out of 8. The other series that I have a hand in editing is the Evangelical Biblical Theology Commentary with Lexham at a projected 40 volumes. So, you know, there, I think we've only published 3 of them. So we got 37 more volumes to go. So you're a wise man, because I read that you limited the number of volumes in the series you're editing. And of course, we'd be remiss not to mention the NSBT series edited by my esteemed mentor, D.A. Carson, which is, of course, in turn patterned after the classic SBT, the Studies in Biblical Theology series from years ago. So, you know, in that light, why don't you say a few words about the new series you're editing, Essential Studies in Biblical Theology?
Yeah, so that's a great question. That idea came to me several years ago, maybe 3 years ago or 4 years ago, when I was at ETS. I can't remember what city we were in, but I pitched that idea to Andy LePue, who was the editor, senior editor at IVP at the time, and Dan Reed. And I asked them, I said, hey, what? This was at their booth. This was at the IVP booth. And I said, what if we did a series, what makes this series unique is that you limit it to 10 volumes and you pitch it at a lay level, not lay level. It's accessible, but yeah, you can get into stuff and it's 10 volumes and you go from Genesis to Revelation. You just go start at the beginning, go to the end, and you really sort of give them a nice overview, sort of a framework in which to write the volumes. And they really liked it. Dan Reed really, really liked it. And he got back to me soon after, and we started to come up with a list. And that's kind of how it started. So I wrote the first volume, Adam and Israel, From Adam and Israel to the Church, A Biblical Theology of the People of God. I wrote that volume to sort of set the tone, the rhythm for the entire series. What makes it unique is that it is biblical theological, that it stretches both testaments. I'm a huge fan of Carson's NSBT set. I think that's stellar. There are some volumes, though, that's like, okay, so it's Isaiah. So Abernathy on Isaiah, it's very good. But he spends a lot of it's Isaiah, or then there's Job, or So what I wanted to do here with this one is, no, let's go a little bit broader, and let's go from Genesis to Revelation. And so it's a little broader in at some level, but there's not as much ST in there, not as much systematics that can get into the NSBT, like Andre Blochet's. That one's pretty theological. It's very, very good, but it's pretty heavy duty theology. So that was really one major characteristic is that it stretches both testaments, and then it's accessible, and then it's only 10 volumes. We're just limiting it to 10. Mm-hmm. So I really like it. I'm editing Desmond Alexander's volume now. We finished 4 or 5 of these things, and they're going to be rolling out starting. The second one comes out next month. Michael Morales on the Passover and Exodus, which is so good. Volume 3 comes out in October. Matt Harmon on Sin and Exile. The fourth one comes out in the spring by Brandon Crow on Covenant and Law, which is great. So we really have everything's kind of in motion now. It's pretty exciting.
That sounds fantastic. You mentioned your inaugural volume from Adam and Israel to the Church. So let's get into that subject. What is your approach to the Israel-Church relationship in this volume? And you can explain maybe how you align with various schools of thought, as you mentioned before.
So I teach at RTS, Reformed Theological Seminary. And at the heart of Reformed theology is, of course, you have the five solas. If you were really to dig down even deeper, the backbone of Reformed theology is God's covenantal relationship with his people, and how that takes place, how it works itself out in the five souls. So I am unashamedly a covenant theologian. That's where I work. That's my entire framework, my broad systematic framework. That's very different from where I grew up. And so I kind of migrated from a dispensational framework that sees a distant relationship, or at least not strained, but Israel and the church as being two separate entities, to now within covenant theology, where now they're brought together. And so it really changes how you put the two testaments together. So in light of that, I said, well, hey, I want to write a book on how we as the church today identify with God's people in the Old Testament and ultimately Adam and Eve. But instead of me, so most books do this through the lens of covenant, which is fine, which is the way to do it. But I'm going to use the lens of image of God. And so I'm going to bring both. So I'm going to bring our identity in Christ and Israel's identity as a covenant community in the image of God, and Adam and Eve's identity in the image of God. And so I'm going to align all three of those together and kind of watch it unfold. That's essentially what I'm doing there.
So, you know, put you on the spot here. Somebody were to say the church started in Acts 2, how would you respond?
That's a great question. I mean, the term ecclesia is even, I mean, that even goes back to, I think it's Ezra and Nehemiah in the LXX. I mean, that's you know, there are seeds that even that term ecclesia goes back way before the New Testament. And it even crops up again in Matthew. And that's one of the most, that's a very difficult text there, with Peter there in Matthew 18. So there is at some level, something changes at Pentecost. And I would say that there's some sort of a structural change in God's people, that we are now, the Spirit is now being poured out. And this is going to be the major component there. The Spirit is now really poured out upon God's people. Now, not that he was absent in the Old Testament. And my view, I know this is debated, that in the Old Testament, my view, everybody, all believers were possessed by the Spirit. And in the New Testament, we're possessed, but even in a greater way. So that greater way takes place there at Pentecost. So there is a change, a deepening, a tightening of our relationship to God, at a formal level, if you want to call it that. So I would say, I wouldn't say it radically starts in Acts 2. I would say it's a momentous occasion. How about that? It's a tentpole. It's a tentpole in God's program. It's a movement.
Yes. And again, you know, sorely tempted. Greg Allison and I just published a book on the Holy Spirit. So I'm sorely tempted to, you know, keep following up, but we're here to talk about your book, not mine. So let's keep going with.
Yeah, it's good though. Like, it's good. I mean, I think Schreiner's in that camp, and I know Jim Hamilton. I think Jim Hamilton did his dissertation on that subject, I believe. And so yeah, I know it's really debated. And I think, and honestly, I do think at the end of the day, I think we're pretty close to each other once you really start to get involved in the conversation. I think you'd be really, really close.
Yeah. And again, certainly right here, I think for our listeners, it's helpful just to be exploratory and to unpack that topic as a bit of a case study, right? This being the inaugural volume of that Essential Biblical Theology series, which is such a great idea. So I think maybe what we can do is just give people a few highlights from your book and have you kind of flesh some of those out. So starting at the beginning, you start with Adam and Eve, and you use that that grid, if you will, saying that Adam and Eve, and this may be new to some of our listeners, so it'd be good for you to common, that they were kings, priests, and prophets in the Garden of Eden. And so I think maybe, you know, we're both interested in hermeneutics. So I think that would be a good example of how hermeneutics does inform biblical theology. So, you know, what is your hermeneutic as you read the creation narrative that, you know, leads you to come up with this taxonomy, if you will, Adam and Eve as kings, priests, and prophets? And how does Eve in particular fit into the role of prophet, priest, and king? I know in the title you say, you know, from Adam and Israel to the church, but you include Eve in that as well.
Yeah. So I'll unpack both those questions. Mm-hmm. Very good. Just in how I am going to read Genesis 1-3, you have to go forward and backward. So you start with Genesis 3, you exegete it, you read it, and then you see how it unfolds in the rest of the Pentateuch, and then you see how the rest of the Pentateuch unfolds in the Old Testament, and then you go into the New Testament, you read the New Testament, and then you go back to Genesis with the New Testament eyes, with greater clarity, and you start to reread it. So you're constantly, you at the end of the day, the New Testament is going to bring clarity, is going to bring insight into what is already in the Old Testament. And so that actually will help us read the creation narrative there with Adam and Eve. So we really can. And I think 1 Corinthians 15 really bears this out. Paul is reading Genesis 1-2 there in a very interesting way about calling how the first Adam is of the earth, and how the of the earth, of the old Adam, of the earth, of the old age, and that the last Adam is of heaven, of the new creation, of the spirit. If you read Second Temple literature, especially in the Qumran material, they were saying the opposite. They were saying, oh, the first Adam is so amazing. He has glory. He has he's full of all this amazing stuff. And Paul says, well, that's true. That's true. However, he's of the earth. And so it's this. So what happens is that Paul is rereading Genesis 2 in light of Christ, and he's bringing more insight there. So that's going to be sort of how I read the Bible in general. I always let the New Testament give the final word, and it does affect things. And does that make sense? Does that make sense? And
yeah, Andreas? That's very helpful. I think that's exactly what I was after. Just I think that's very illuminating. Just, you know, how you approach, just how you read the Bible, because that pretty much then predetermines the outcome to some extent. And so, as you said, kind of was a two-part question, you know, how does Eve fit into that kind of threefold taxonomy?
Yeah. So then the second part, right? So the second part is, so Adam and Eve, prophet, priest, and king. Eve, she's prophet, priest, and king. They are both ontologically equal. They're both made in God's image. They are both worthy. They are dignified, right? So you get Psalm 8 in there. They are, you know, look at how amazing they are. The pinnacle of creation. However, even though they're ontologically the same, they have different roles. So even though Eve is a priest or priestess, and even though she's a prophet or a prophetess and a king or queen, however you want to label that, the way she works that out is going to be different from how Adam works out his. And so this is where I would say, I'm a complementarian. Even before the fall, it's supposed to be worked out a certain way. So they, even though they have the same dignity and ontology, the way that they use their roles are going to be different. Even though they still are kings, the way that she works with her children, interacts with them, interacts with the created environment, the cultural mandate, she's going to complement Adam. So does that make sense? I'm pretty
it
sure
does,
you would agree.
And, yes. And that was part of, you know, my question. I think the other part might be, and again, you know, I know we want to keep things moving to give a good survey of your book, but just briefly, you know, the idea that in the Old Testament, obviously priests, right, especially the Levites, were male, right? I mean, you can see that that's something. I'm wondering now, if Eve was a priestess, then, you know, it doesn't seem like it kind of carries through you know, in the rest of the Old Testament.
Right. But I mean, you have to think in terms of, I mean, she's in God's temple there in the garden. She's going to mediate God's presence to her children. And she's going to help Adam work it out there, expand, sort of push the boundaries outside of the garden. This is sort of what Beale's going to argue or what he does argue. So she's going to assist that. We just don't have data. Scripture doesn't quite speak to this and how, what that looks like precisely. We kind of have to, I think, imply it and infer it there. But when it's carried out, you're right. When it's carried out, it is the men who are going to do that. What's interesting though about the prophets, the prophetic piece is really interesting because in Joel 2, right, we get the prophecy with the pouring out of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. And then it says that everybody will know the Lord. Everybody will be able to teach one another. Because remember, priests, they bear the responsibility for teaching the Israelites God's law. But then in the new covenant, all the women are priests. That's how I interpret that text in Jeremiah and the one in Joel 2 about the teaching aspect. I connect that both to prophet and to priest. Mm-hmm. But it's just going to be different, right? Because it's going to work itself out in different roles.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, as we move on to Israel, you talk about their role, obviously, through prophet, priest, and king. And how do you balance the corporate dimension with the fact that only certain individuals served as kings, priests, and prophets?
Right. That's a great question. So what happens in the fall is that the divine image then becomes split into three different offices. Mm-hmm. So Adam, and I would say Eve here, but we'll focus on Adam. So Adam is created in God's image. God is the prophet, priest, and king. And Adam, because he is in God's image, he too is the prophet, priest, and king. He does what God does. But what happens after the fall is that these three offices are split up into official offices, which is what we get. I think it's Deuteronomy 18 and 19, or is it 17 and 18? It's right in there where we have the three offices now are assigned because we're now in the fall, post-fall world, that the offices are split up. But every once in a while in the Old Testament, we get hints of the three offices coming back together. For example, David's a prophet, priest, and king. He wrote many Psalms. He is obviously a king, and he's a prophet too. And he donned an ephod and went into the tabernacle. So he has some sort of a priestly capacity. Moses, I would say the same thing about Moses. So every once in a while, we get these prophet, priest, and king figures. But then in the New Testament, it's now all of God's people have this. Now, I will say this. One of the things when I'm writing the book, I sort of landed on, and I think I've refined it a little bit better now, is when, even after the fall, we still have, or people, everybody has, fallen humanity still has God's image imprinted in or on them. The fall does not efface God's image. It perverts it. It messes it up. In other words, unbelievers, I mean, if you think about it, unbelievers are still prophet, priest, and king. But they abuse those three offices, and they use them for their own destruction, or for their own, I should say, gain, but ultimate destruction. And so what I try to then argue, and this is a unique piece, and I really haven't seen many people talk about it. So I call it the anti-image, or the anti-king, the anti-priest, and the anti-prophet. So it's the exact opposite of the divine commission. So instead of ruling on behalf of God, an unbeliever rules as God and abuses power. Instead of keeping the temple clean from defilement, the anti-priest defiles the temple. And the prophet, instead of speaking on behalf of God, speaks lies and speaks as God. So it's this anti, and that figure is going to culminate in the Antichrist, which is what we get in on into the New Testament. So that's sort of a, I try to highlight that a little bit in the book, but I thought that was a fascinating discussion to have along with the covenant community and what that looks like.
Yeah. And again, we're just kind of doing a flyover here. I certainly recommend for people to pick up your book and to, you know, get into some of the details. I know it's sometimes hard to do full justice to it, you know, in a short, podcast like this, but for now, moving into the New Testament, you continue with this, prophets, priests, kings idea, and you argue that the 12 were prophets, priests, and kings as well. Where do you see this in the Gospels or, you know, Paul, some of the other letters?
Yeah, that's great. So you really see it in the commissions. There are a couple of commissions, like in Matthew 10, we get an initial commission. That commission for the 12 is only for Israel. And then in Matthew 28, which is what we call the Great Commission, that's now for the nations. In these commissions, or the commissioning of the 72, not just the 12, but the 72 in there in Luke, we get traces of this stuff. We get kingly and even priestly language interspersed in there. And so you start to see them now that Jesus is now refashioning his disciples, and he is now in light of his work in the wilderness temptation, he is now empowering his disciples to then become refashioned, restored images, so that they can then spread the gospel to others, who then they also can be restored in God's image as prophet, priest, and king. So he is the consummate prophet, priest, and king. He then restores it in his disciples, and then they too are supposed to then take that off. And I think you really can see it very well, or at least more clearly, in the commissioning. That's where I see them. I don't know if you've seen anywhere else, Andreas, but that's where
or
like in the overthrow of the demons.
It's interesting. We're having that conversation, and I didn't really think about it before we sat down for the podcast, but as you may know, of course, I wrote my dissertation on the sending theme in John's gospel.
Right,
and so
right.
It's kind of interesting I think about it. And like you said, especially at the commissioning there in John 20:21. So my findings in my dissertation were that the disciples are basically Jesus' messengers. They're his representatives, you know, basically passing on the message, the good news. That's not about them. It's about Jesus. And so just from reading of John's gospel, at least, you know, more within a kind of Johannine theology orbit,
right.
I'll be honest with you, I would not have probably naturally come up with this priest, prophet, king, you know, template. I probably would have come up more with kind of a messenger, you know, sending, label kind of within John's overall, you know, sending Christologies. So again, this is unscripted here, but how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I think it fits in very well. It's just that he's not going, I think John's is so Christological, and it's so, I'm going to totally use this word is used, it's almost overused, but it's so cosmic and apocalyptic. Like, it's so synthetic. It's so massive, right? That it's these broad strokes. And so the prophet, priest, and king dimension would go inside that. You see, it would fit inside that. So the sending is a more synthetic and broad and cosmic way of stating what I'm stating. I think unpack that. And also, I've started to notice this more because I just finished this book on the Gospels, that I think you've got to tie it to the exorcisms that when he commands his disciples to exorcise demons. I mean, that's clearly a royal in a kingly dimension. At least I think it's tied to their royal status, very military in language. But I think it's also tied to their priestly status, because these demons, and this is very strong in Mark's gospel, they're called unclean spirits. Very unique to Mark, unclean spirits. And so there are these priests, Jesus is commissioning these priest kings to remove defilement from people, to remove defilement from creation as sort of newly installed priest kings. So I would want to see that as well. I think it's the exorcism is one of the clear. So the commissioning, specifically the exorcism, you really see it.
Yes, we'll have to leave it there for now. But in the final chapter, you know, just finishing out the book, you discuss the church in the new creation. So I think some might be surprised that, you know, to hear those juxtaposed, you know, the church and new creation, because they may suppose that believers will be part of God's kingdom in the new creation. So can you explain any reason why you don't say, you know, why you don't link kingdom with new creation, why you link the church in the new creation, or is that just the title?
It's just the title.
Yeah.
It's just the title. I've read some books on heaven, and they tend to be really goofy. And again, this is sort of my dispensational upbringing here, and I haven't read any recent books on heaven, but there aren't many out there. The ones that are odd. So I kind of wanted to come at this question and say, I want to talk about heaven, or what I mean there by heaven, I mean the new heavens, the new earth, the eternal state. After the general resurrection, after Christ coming, when he establishes us, he establishes his community in the eternal state. What does that look like with regard to the church or God's people as prophet, priest, and kings? And one of the things that I noticed in Revelation 21 and 22 is that there is very explicit, and I think it's explicit, mention of priests, because everybody, the church, every person in the church has the word, only the high priest had God's name on their forehead. Well, now everybody, because everybody is now a high priest, everybody has God's name written on their forehead. So that's priestly. And then the kingly dimension, there's an allusion there. I can't remember which verse it is, but there's an allusion to Daniel 7 about reigning and ruling. So that's the kingly dimension. And then the prophetic dimension would just be, we all know God's word, we're speaking it to one another, that sort of idea. So I kind of want to explore, what does this look like in its consummate state? And we are fully restored now as kings, priests, and prophets. And so, I think this gives us good fodder. This gives us a good ingredients to have really good discussions about what our lives will be like in the world to come, and our relationship to the new creation, to the cosmos, because I think we can really start to study this and work it out.
Thank you for joining us today at Biblical Foundations. For more information, please visit the Center for Biblical Studies at Midwestern at cbs.mbts.edu. For further resources, please also visit biblicalfoundations.org. Please join us again next time at the Biblical Foundations podcast.
Midwestern Seminary's 81-hour Master of Divinity degree prepares you for ministry today and tomorrow. Midwestern Seminary's flagship degree program is our primary track for ministry preparation. Requiring only 81 credit hours, the MDiv program is an efficient option for students, equipping them to serve the church in pastoral ministry. Residential students will be trained in a unique community environment passionately focused on the local church. Online students can earn the full degree without leaving their current ministry context. Come be a part of one of the fastest growing seminaries in North America as we develop a new culture of discipleship devoted to the local church and committed to taking God's unchanging word into a rapidly changing world. Visit mbts.edu/mdiv today.